This secret life should be revealed and confessed. No longer would he live it clandestinely. He would go and tell her all. And that is what he did. He told her all, and wept upon her bosom, wept and moaned and begged her for forgiveness. It was a profound shock, and she staggered under the blow. But he was her own, the core of her heart, the blessing of her eyes, her all in all. She could deny him nothing, and she forgave him. She felt that he could never again be quite to her what he had been before. She knew that he could only repent and not reform. Yet, all morally defaced and decayed as he was he not her own, her very own, the idol of her deathless worship? She said she was his serf, his slave, and she opened her yearning heart and took him in. Chapter 7. One Sunday afternoon, some time after this, they were sailing the summer seas in their dream yacht, and reclining in lazy luxury under the awning of the afterdeck. There was silence, for each was busy with his own thoughts. These seasons of silence had insensibly been growing more and more frequent of late. The old nearness and cordiality were waning. Sally's terrible revelation had done its work. Alec had tried hard to drive the memory of it out of her mind, but it would not go, and the shame and bitterness of it were poisoning her gracious dream life. She could see now, on Sundays, that her husband was becoming a bloated and repulsive thing. She could not close her eyes to this, and in these days she no longer looked at him, Sundays, when she could help it. But she, was she herself without blemish? Alas, she knew she was not. She was keeping a secret from him. She was acting dishonorably toward him, and many a pang it was costing her. She was breaking the compact and concealing it from him. Under strong temptation, she had gone into business again. She had risked their whole fortune in a purchase of all the railway systems and coal and steel companies in the country on a margin, and she was now trembling every Sabbath hour, lest through some chance word of hers he find it out. In her misery and remorse for this treachery, she could not keep her heart from going out to him in pity. She was filled with compunctions to see him lying there, drunk and content, and never suspecting, trusting her with a perfect and pathetic trust, and she holding over him by a thread a possible calamity of so devastating a...
"Say, Alec?"
The interrupting words brought her suddenly to herself. She was grateful to have that persecuting subject from her thoughts, and she answered, with much of the old-time tenderness in her tone, "Yes, dear?"
"Do you know, Alec, I think we are making a mistake. That is, you are. I mean about the marriage business."
He sat up, fat and froggy and benevolent, like a bronze Buddha, and grew earnest.
"Consider. It's more than 5 years. You've continued the same policy from the start, with every rise always holding on for 5 points higher. Always when I think we're going to have some weddings, you see a bigger thing ahead, and I undergo another disappointment. I think you are too hard to please. Some day we'll get left. First we turned down the dentist and the lawyer. That was all right. It was sound. Next we turned down the banker's son and the pork butcher's heir. Right again, and sound. Next we turned down the congressman's son and the governor's. Right as a trivet, I confess it. Next the senator's son and the son of the vice president of the United States. Perfectly right. There's no permanency about those little distinctions. And then you went for the aristocracy, and I thought we had struck oil at last. Yes, we would make a plunge at the 400, and pull in some ancient lineage, venerable, holy, ineffable, mellow with the antiquity of 150 years, disinfected of the ancestral odors of salt cod and pelts all of a century ago, and unsmirched by a day's work since. And then, why then the marriages, of course. But no, along comes a pair of real aristocrats from Europe, and straightway you throw over the half-breeds. It was awfully discouraging, Alec. Since then, what a procession! You turned down the baronets for a pair of barons, you turned down the barons for a pair of viscounts, the viscounts for a pair of earls, the earls for a pair of marquesses, the marquesses for a brace of dukes. Now, Alec, cash in. You've played the limit. You've got a job lot of 4 dukes under the hammer, of 4 nationalities, all sound in wind and limb and pedigree, all bankrupt and in debt up to the ears. They come high, but we can afford it. Come, Alec, don't delay any longer. Don't keep up the suspense. Take the whole layout and leave the girls to choose. Alec had been smiling blandly and contentedly all through this arraignment of her marriage policy. A pleasant light, as of triumph, with perhaps a nice surprise peeping out through it, rose in her eyes, and she said as calmly as she could, "Sally, what would you say to royalty?"
Prodigious! Poor man, it knocked him silly, and he fell over the garboard strake and barked his shin on the catheads. He was dizzy for a moment. Then he gathered himself up and limped over and sat down by his wife and beamed his old-time admiration and affection upon her in floods out of his bleary eyes.
"By George," he said fervently, "Alec, you are great, the greatest woman in the whole earth. I can't ever learn the whole size of you. I can't ever learn the immeasurable deeps of you. Here I've been considering myself qualified to criticize your game. Why, if I had stopped to think, I'd have known you had a lone hand up your sleeve. Now, dear heart, I'm all red-hot impatience. Tell me about it."
The flattered and happy woman put her lips to his ear and whispered a princely name. It made him catch his breath. It lit his face with exultation.
"Land," he said. "It's a stunning catch. He's got a gambling hell and a graveyard and a bishop and a cathedral, all his very own, and all gilt-edged 500% stock, every detail of it, the tidiest little property in Europe. And that graveyard, it's the selectest in the world. None but suicides admitted. Yes, sir, and the free list suspended, too, all the time. There isn't much land in the principality, but there's enough. 800 acres in the graveyard and 42 outside. It's a sovereignty. That's the main thing. Land's nothing. There's plenty land. Sahara's drugged with it."
Alec glowed. She was profoundly happy. She said, "Think of it, Sally. It is a family that has never married outside the royal and imperial houses of Europe. Our grandchildren will sit upon thrones."
"True as you live, Alec, and bear scepters, too, and handle them as naturally and nonchalantly as I handle a yardstick. It's a grand catch, Alec. He's corralled, is he? Can't get away. You didn't take him on a margin?"
"No, trust me for that. He's not a liability, he's an asset. So is the other one."
"Who is it, Alec?"
"His Royal Highness Sigismund Siegfried Lauenfeld Dinkelspiel Schwarzburg Blutwurst, hereditary Grand Duke of Katzenjammer."
"No, you can't mean it."
"It's as true as I'm sitting here, I give you my word," she answered. His cup was full, and he hugged her to his heart with rapture, saying,
"How wonderful it all seems, and how beautiful! It's one of the oldest and noblest of the 364 ancient German principalities, and one of the few that was allowed to retain its royal estate when Bismarck got done trimming them. I know that farm. I've been there. It's got a rope walk and a candle factory and an army. Standing army. Infantry and cavalry. 3 soldiers and a horse.
Alec, it's been a long wait and full of heartbreak and hope deferred, but God knows I am happy now, happy and grateful to you, my own, who have done it all. When is it to be?
Next Sunday.
Good. And we'll want to do these weddings up in the very regalest style that's going. It's properly due to the royal quality of the parties of the first part. Now, as I understand it, there is only one kind of marriage that is sacred to royalty, exclusive to royalty. It's the morganatic.
What do they call it that for, Sally?
I don't know. But anyway, it's royal, and royal only.
Then we will insist upon it. More, I will compel it. It is morganatic marriage or none.
That settles it, said Sally, rubbing his hands with delight. And it will be the very first in America. Alec, it will make Newport sick.
Then they fell silent and drifted away upon their dream wings to the far regions of the earth to invite all the crowned heads and their families and provide gratis transportation for them. Chapter 8. During 3 days the couple walked upon air with their heads in the clouds. They were but vaguely conscious of their surroundings. They saw all things dimly, as through a veil. They were steeped in dreams. Often they did not hear when they were spoken to. They often did not understand when they heard. They answered confusedly or at random. Sally sold molasses by weight, sugar by the yard, and furnished soap when asked for candles, and Alec put the cat in the wash and fed milk to the soiled linen. Everybody was stunned and amazed, and went about muttering, "What can be the matter with the Fosters?" 3 days. Then came events. Things had taken a happy turn, and for 48 hours Alec's imaginary corner had been booming. Up, up, still up. Cost point was passed, still up. And up, and up. 5 points above cost, then 10, 15, 20. 20 points cold profit on the vast venture now, and Alec's imaginary brokers were shouting frantically, by imaginary long distance, "Sell! Sell! For heaven's sake, sell!" She broke the splendid news to Sally, and he too said, "Sell, sell! Oh, don't make a blunder now, you own the earth! Sell, sell!" But she set her iron will and lashed it amidships, and said she would hold on for 5 points more if she died for it. It was a fatal resolve. The very next day came the historic crash, the record crash, the devastating crash, when the bottom fell out of Wall Street, and the whole body of gilt-edged stocks dropped 95 points in 5 hours, and the multimillionaire was seen begging his bread in the Bowery. Alec sternly held her grip and put up as long as she could, but at last there came a call which she was powerless to meet, and her imaginary brokers sold her out. Then, and not till then, the man in her was vanquished, and the woman in her resumed sway. She put her arms about her husband's neck and wept, saying,
"I am to blame. Do not forgive me. I cannot bear it. We are paupers, paupers, and I am so miserable. The weddings will never come off. All that is past. We could not even buy the dentist now."
A bitter reproach was on Sally's tongue. "I begged you to sell, but you—"
He did not say it. He had not the heart to add a hurt to that broken and repentant spirit. A nobler thought came to him, and he said,
"Bear up, my Alec. All is not lost. You never really invested a penny of my uncle's bequest, but only its unmaterialized future. What we have lost was only the increment harvested from that future by your incomparable financial judgment and sagacity. Cheer up. Banish these griefs. We still have the 30,000 untouched. And with the experience which you have acquired, think what you will be able to do with it in a couple of years. The marriages are not off.
They are only postponed." These were blessed words. Alec saw how true they were, and their influence was electric. Her tears ceased to flow, and her great spirit rose to its full stature again. With flashing eye and grateful heart, and with hand uplifted in pledge and prophecy, she said, "Now and here I proclaim—" But she was interrupted by a visitor. It was the editor and proprietor of the Sagamore. He had happened into Lakeside to pay a duty call upon an obscure grandmother of his, who was nearing the end of her pilgrimage, and with the idea of combining business with grief, he had looked up the Fosters, who had been so absorbed in other things for the past 4 years that they had neglected to pay up their subscription, $6 due. No visitor could have been more welcome. He would know all about Uncle Tilbury, and what his chances might be getting to be. Cemetery words. They could, of course, ask no questions, for that would squelch the bequest, but they could nibble around on the edge of the subject and hope for results. The scheme did not work. The obtuse editor did not know he was being nibbled at. But at last, chance accomplished what art had failed in. In illustration of something under discussion, which required the help of metaphor, the editor said,
"Land, it's as tough as Tilbury Foster, as we say."
It was sudden, and it made the Fosters jump. The editor noticed it, and said apologetically,
"No harm intended, I assure you. It's just a saying. Just a joke, you know. Nothing in it. Relation of yours?"
Sally crowded his burning eagerness down, and answered with all the indifference he could assume,
"Well, not that I know of, but we've heard of him."
The editor was thankful and resumed his composure. Sally added,
Is he well?
"Is he well? Why, bless you, he's in Sheol these 5 years."
The Fosters were trembling with grief, though it felt like joy. Sally said, noncommittally and tentatively,
Well, such is life, and none can escape. Not even the rich are spared."
The editor laughed.
"If you are including Tilbury," said he, "it don't apply. He hadn't a cent. The town had to bury him."
The Fosters sat petrified for 2 minutes, petrified and cold. Then, white-faced and weak-voiced, Sally asked,
"Is it true? Do you know it to be true?"
"Well, I should say, I was one of the executors. He hadn't anything to leave but a wheelbarrow, and he left that to me. It hadn't any wheel, and wasn't any good. Still, it was something. And so, to square up, I scribbled off a sort of a little obituarial send-off for him. But it got crowded out."
The Fosters were not listening. Their cup was full. It could contain no more. They sat with bowed heads, dead to all things but the ache at their hearts. An hour later, still they sat there, bowed, motionless, silent. The visitor long ago gone, they unaware. Then they stirred and lifted their heads wearily and gazed at each other wistfully, dreamily, dazed. Then presently began to twaddle to each other in a wandering and childish way. At intervals they lapsed into silences, leaving a sentence unfinished, seemingly either unaware of it or losing their way. Sometimes, when they woke out of these silences, they had a dim and transient consciousness that something had happened to their minds. Then, with a dumb and yearning solicitude, they would softly caress each other's hands in mutual compassion and support, as if they would say, "I am near you. I will not forsake you. We will bear it together." Somewhere there is release and forgetfulness. Somewhere there is a grave and peace. Be patient. It will not be long. They lived yet 2 years in mental night, always brooding, steeped in vague regrets and melancholy dreams, never speaking. Then release came to both on the same day. Toward the end, the darkness lifted from Sally's ruined mind for a moment, and he said,
"Vast wealth acquired by sudden and unwholesome means is a snare. It did us no good. Transient were its feverish pleasures. Yet for its sake we threw away our sweet and simple and happy life. Let others take warning by us."
He lay silent a while with closed eyes. Then, as the chill of death crept upward toward his heart, and consciousness was fading from his brain, he muttered,
"Money had brought him misery, and he took his revenge upon us, who had done him no harm. He had his desire. With base and cunning calculation he left us but 30,000, knowing we would try to increase it, and ruin our life and break our hearts. Without added expense he could have left us far above desire of increase, far above the temptation to speculate, and a kinder soul would have done it. But in him was no generous spirit, no pity, no—"
1904. Eve's Diary, translated from the original. Saturday. I am almost a whole day old now. I arrived yesterday. That is, as it seems to me. And it must be so, for if there was a day before yesterday, I was not there when it happened, or I should remember it. It could be, of course, that it did happen and that I was not noticing. Very well, I will be very watchful now, and if any day before yesterday's happen, I will make a note of it. It will be best to start right and not let the record get confused, for some instinct tells me that these details are going to be important to the historian some day. For I feel like an experiment. I feel exactly like an experiment. It would be impossible for a person to feel more like an experiment than I do, and so I am coming to feel convinced that that is what I am. An experiment. Just an experiment, and nothing more. Then, if I am an experiment, am I the whole of it? No, I think not. I think the rest of it is part of it. I am the main part of it, but I think the rest of it has its share in the matter. Is my position assured, or do I have to watch it and take care of it? The latter, perhaps. Some instinct tells me that eternal vigilance is the price of supremacy. That is a good phrase, I think, for one so young. Everything looks better today than it did yesterday. In the rush of finishing up yesterday, the mountains were left in a ragged condition, and some of the plains were so cluttered with rubbish and remnants that the aspects were quite distressing. Noble and beautiful works of art should not be subjected to haste, and this majestic new world is indeed a most noble and beautiful work, and certainly marvelously near to being perfect, notwithstanding the shortness of the time. There are too many stars in some places, and not enough in others. But that can be remedied presently, no doubt. The moon got loose last night, and slid down and fell out of the scheme. A very great loss. It breaks my heart to think of it. There isn't another thing among the ornaments and decorations that is comparable to it for beauty and finish. It should have been fastened better. If we can only get it back again. But, of course, there is no telling where it went to. And besides, whoever gets it will hide it. I know it, because I would do it myself. I believe I can be honest in all other matters, but I already begin to realize that the core and center of my nature is love of the beautiful, a passion for the beautiful, and that it would not be safe to trust me with a moon that belonged to another person, and that person didn't know I had it. I could give up a moon that I found in the daytime, because I should be afraid someone was looking. But if I found it in the dark, I am sure I should find some kind of an excuse for not saying anything about it. For I do love moons. They are so pretty and so romantic. I wish we had 5 or 6. I would never go to bed. I should never get tired lying on the moss bank and looking up at them. Stars are good, too. I wish I could get some to put in my hair, but I suppose I never can. You would be surprised to find how far off they are, for they do not look it. When they first showed last night, I tried to knock some down with a pole, but it didn't reach, which astonished me. Then I tried clods till I was all tired out, but I never got one. It was because I am left-handed and cannot throw good. Even when I aimed at the one I wasn't after, I couldn't hit the other one. Though I did make some close shots, for I saw the black blot of the clod sail right into the midst of the golden clusters 40 or 50 times, just barely missing them. And if I could have held out a little longer, maybe I could have got one. So I cried a little, which was natural, I suppose, for one of my age. And after I was rested, I got a basket and started for a place on the extreme rim of the circle, where the stars were close to the ground, and I could get them with my hands, which would be better anyway, because I could gather them tenderly and not break them. But it was farther than I thought, and at last I had to give it up. I was so tired I couldn't drag my feet another step, and besides they were sore and hurt me very much. I couldn't get back home. It was too far and turning cold, but I found some tigers and nestled in among them, and was most adorably comfortable, and their breath was sweet and pleasant, because they live on strawberries. I had never seen a tiger before, but I knew them in a minute by the stripes. If I could have one of those skins, it would make a lovely gown. Today I am getting better ideas about distances. I was so eager to get hold of every pretty thing that I giddily grabbed for it, sometimes when it was too far off, and sometimes when it was but 6 inches away but seemed a foot. Alas, with thorns between! I learned a lesson. Also I made an axiom, all out of my own head, my very first one. The scratched experiment shuns the thorn. I think it is a very good one. For one so young. I followed the other experiment around yesterday afternoon, at a distance, to see what it might be for, if I could, but I was not able to make out. I think it is a man. I had never seen a man, but it looked like one, and I feel sure that that is what it is. I realize that I feel more curiosity about it than about any of the other reptiles, if it is a reptile. And I suppose it is, for it has frowsy hair and blue eyes and looks like a reptile. It has no hips. It tapers like a carrot. When it stands, it spreads itself apart like a derrick. So I think it is a reptile, though it may be architecture. I was afraid of it at first and started to run every time it turned around, for I thought it was going to chase me, but by and by I found it was only trying to get away. So after that I was not timid any more, but tracked it along several hours, about 20 yards behind, which made it nervous and unhappy. At last it was a good deal worried, and climbed a tree. I waited a good while, then gave it up and went home. Today the same thing over. I've got it up the tree again. Sunday. It is up there yet. Resting, apparently. But that is a subterfuge. Sunday isn't the day of rest. Saturday is appointed for that. It looks to me like a creature that is more interested in resting than anything else. It would tire me to rest so much. It tires me just to sit around and watch the tree. I do wonder what it is for. I never see it do anything. They returned the moon last night, and I was so happy. I think it is very honest of them. It slid down and fell off again, but I was not distressed.
There is no need to worry when one has that kind of neighbors. They will fetch it back. I wish I could do something to show my appreciation. I would like to send them some stars, for we have more than we can use. I mean I, not we, for I can see that the reptile cares nothing for such things. It has low tastes, and is not kind. When I went there yesterday evening in the gloaming, it had crept down and was trying to catch the little speckled fishes that play in the pool, and I had to clod it to make it go up the tree again and let them alone. I wonder if that is what it is for. Hasn't it any heart? Hasn't it any compassion for those little creatures? Can it be that it was designed and manufactured for such ungentle work? It has the look of it. One of the clods took it back of the ear, and it used language. It gave me a thrill, for it was the first time I had ever heard speech, except my own. I did not understand the words, but they seemed expressive. When I found it could talk, I felt a new interest in it, for I love to talk. I talk all day, and in my sleep, too, and I am very interesting. But if I had another to talk to, I could be twice as interesting, and would never stop, if desired. If this reptile is a man, it isn't an it, is it? That wouldn't be grammatical, would it? I think it would be he. I think so. In that case, one would parse it thus. Nominative, he. Dative, him. Possessive, his'n. Well, I will consider it a man and call it he until it turns out to be something else. This will be handier than having so many uncertainties. Next week, Sunday. All the week I tagged around after him and tried to get acquainted. I had to do the talking because he was so shy, but I didn't mind it. He seemed pleased to have me around, and I used the sociable we a good deal, because it seemed to flatter him to be included. Wednesday. We are getting along very well indeed now, and getting better and better acquainted. He does not try to avoid me any more, which is a good sign, and shows that he likes to have me with him. That pleases me, and I study to be useful to him in every way I can, so as to increase his regard. During the last day or two I have taken all the work of naming things off his hands, and this has been a great relief to him, for he has no gift in that line, and is evidently very grateful. He can't think of a rational name to save him, but I do not let him see that I am aware of his defect. Whenever a new creature comes along, I name it before he has time to expose himself by an awkward silence. In this way I have saved him many embarrassments. I have no defect like his. The minute I set eyes on an animal, I know what it is. I don't have to reflect a moment. The right name comes out instantly, just as if it were an inspiration, as no doubt it is, for I'm sure it wasn't in me half a minute before. I seem to know just by the shape of the creature and the way it acts what animal it is. When the dodo came along, he thought it was a wild cat. I saw it in his eye, but I saved him, and I was careful not to do it in a way that could hurt his pride. I just spoke up in a quite natural way of pleased surprise, and not as if I was dreaming of conveying information, and said, "Well, I do declare if there isn't the dodo." I explained, without seeming to be explaining, how I knew it for a dodo, and although I thought maybe he was a little piqued that I knew the creature when he didn't, it was quite evident that he admired me. That was very agreeable, and I thought of it more than once with gratification before I slept. How little a thing can make us happy when we feel that we have earned it. Thursday, my first sorrow. Yesterday he avoided me, and seemed to wish I would not talk to him. I could not believe it, and thought there was some mistake, for I loved to be with him, and loved to hear him talk. And so how could it be that he could feel unkind towards me when I had not done anything? But at last it seemed true. So I went away, and sat lonely in the place where I first saw him, the morning that we were made, and I did not know what he was, and was indifferent about him. But now it was a mournful place, and every little thing spoke of him, and my heart was very sore. I did not know why very clearly, for it was a new feeling. I had not experienced it before, and it was all a mystery, and I could not make it out. But when night came, I could not bear the lonesomeness, and went to the new shelter which he has built, to ask him what I had done that was wrong, and how I could mend it, and get back his kindness again. But he put me out in the rain, and it was my first sorrow. Sunday. It is pleasant again now, and I am happy, but those were heavy days. I do not think of them when I can help it. I tried to get him some of those apples, but I cannot learn to throw straight. I failed, but I think the good intention pleased him. They are forbidden, and he says I shall come to harm, but so I come to harm through pleasing him. Why shall I care for that harm? Monday. This morning I told him my name, hoping it would interest him, but he did not care for it. It is strange. If he should tell me his name, I would care. I think it would be pleasanter in my ears than any other sound. He talks very little. Perhaps it is because he is not bright, and is sensitive about it, and wishes to conceal it. It is such a pity that he should feel so, for brightness is nothing. It is in the heart that the values lie. I wish I could make him understand that a loving good heart is riches, and riches enough, and that without it, intellect is poverty. Although he talks so little, he has quite a considerable vocabulary. This morning he used a surprisingly good word. He evidently recognized himself that it was a good one, for he worked it in twice afterward, casually. It was not good casual art. Still, it showed that he possesses a certain quality of perception. Without a doubt, that seed can be made to grow, if cultivated. Where did he get that word? I do not think I have ever used it. No, he took no interest in my name. I tried to hide my disappointment, but I suppose I did not succeed. I went away and sat on the moss bank with my feet in the water. It is where I go when I hunger for companionship, someone to look at, someone to talk to. It is not enough, that lovely white body painted there in the pool, but it is something, and something is better than utter loneliness. It talks when I talk, it is sad when I am sad. It comforts me with its sympathy. It says, "Do not be downhearted, you poor friendless girl. I will be your friend." It is a good friend to me, and my only one. It is my sister. That first time that she forsook me, ah, I shall never forget that. Never, never. My heart was lead in my body. I said, "She was all I had, and now she is gone." In my despair, I said, "Break my heart. I cannot bear my life any more," and hid my face in my hands, and there was no solace for me. And when I took them away, after a little, there she was again, white and shining and beautiful, and I sprang into her arms. That was perfect happiness. I had known happiness before, but it was not like this, which was ecstasy. I never doubted her afterwards. Sometimes she stayed away, maybe an hour, maybe almost the whole day, but I waited and did not doubt. I said, "She is busy, or she has gone a journey, but she will come." And it was so. She always did. At night she would not come if it was dark, for she was a timid little thing, but if there was a moon she would come. I am not afraid of the dark, but she is younger than I am. She was born after I was. Many and many are the visits I have paid her. She is my comfort and my refuge when my life is hard, and it is mainly that. Tuesday. all the morning I was at work improving the estate. I purposely kept away from him, in the hope that he would get lonely and come, but he did not. At noon I stopped for the day, and took my recreation by flitting all about with the bees and the butterflies, and reveling in the flowers, those beautiful creatures that catch the smile of God out of the sky and preserve it. I gathered them and made them into wreaths and garlands, and clothed myself in them whilst I ate my luncheon. Apples, of course. Then I sat in the shade and wished and waited, but he did not come. But no matter. Nothing would have come of it, for he does not care for flowers. He calls them rubbish, and cannot tell one from another, and thinks it is superior to feel like that. He does not care for me, he does not care for flowers, he does not care for the painted sky at eventide. Is there anything he does care for, except building shacks to coop himself up in from the good clean rain, and thumping the melons and sampling the grapes and fingering the fruit on the trees to see how those properties are coming along? I laid a dry stick on the ground and tried to bore a hole in it with another one, in order to carry out a scheme that I had, and soon I got an awful fright. A thin, transparent, bluish film rose out of the hole, and I dropped everything and ran. I thought it was a spirit, and I was so frightened. But I looked back, and it was not coming. So I leaned against a rock and rested and panted, and let my limbs go on trembling until they got steady again. Then I crept warily back, alert, watching, and ready to fly if there was occasion. And when I was come near, I parted the branches of a rosebush and peeped through, wishing the man was about, I was looking so cunning and pretty. But the sprite was gone. I went there, and there was a pinch of delicate pink dust in the hole. I put my finger in to feel it, and said, "Ouch!" and took it out again. It was a cruel pain. I put my finger in my mouth, and by standing first on one foot and then the other, and grunting, I presently eased my misery. Then I was full of interest, and began to examine. I was curious to know what the pink dust was. Suddenly the name of it occurred to me, though I had never heard of it before. It was fire. I was as certain of it as a person could be of anything in the world. So, without hesitation, I named it that, fire. I had created something that didn't exist before. I had added a new thing to the world's uncountable properties. I realized this, and was proud of my achievement, and was going to run and find him and tell him about it, thinking to raise myself in his esteem. But I reflected and did not do it. No, he would not care for it. He would ask what it was good for, and what could I answer? For if it was not good for something, but only beautiful, merely beautiful. So I sighed and did not go, for it wasn't good for anything. It could not build a shack, it could not improve melons, it could not hurry a fruit crop. It was useless. It was a foolishness and a vanity. He would despise it and say cutting words. But to me it was not despicable. I said, "Oh, you fire, I love you, you dainty pink creature, for you are beautiful, and that is enough," and was going to gather it to my breast, but refrained. Then I made another maxim out of my own head, though it was so nearly like the first one that I was afraid it was only a plagiarism. The burnt experiment shuns the fire. I wrought again, and when I had made a good deal of fire dust, I emptied it into a handful of dry brown grass, intending to carry it home and keep it always and play with it. But the wind struck it, and it sprayed up and spat out at me fiercely, and I dropped it and ran. When I looked back, the blue spirit was towering up and stretching and rolling away like a cloud, and instantly I thought of the name of it, smoke, though upon my word I had never heard of smoke before. Soon brilliant yellow and red flares shot up through the smoke, and I named them in an instant flames. And I was right, too, though these were the very first flames that had ever been in the world. They climbed the trees. They flashed splendidly in and out of the vast and increasing volume of tumbling smoke, and I had to clap my hands and laugh and dance in my rapture. It was so new and strange, and so wonderful, and so beautiful. He came running, and stopped and gazed, and said not a word for many minutes. Then he asked what it was. Ah, it was too bad that he should ask such a direct question. I had to answer it, of course, and I did. I said it was fire. If it annoyed him that I should know and he must ask, that was not my fault. I had no desire to annoy him. After a pause, he asked, "How did it come?" Another direct question. And it also had to have a direct answer. "I made it." The fire was traveling farther and farther off. He went to the edge of the burned place and stood looking down, and said, "What are these?" "Fire coals." He picked one up to examine it, but changed his mind and put it down again. Then he went away. Nothing interests him. But I was interested. There were ashes, gray and soft and delicate and pretty. I knew what they were at once. And the embers. I knew the embers, too. I found my apples and raked them out, and was glad, for I am very young and my appetite is active. But I was disappointed. They were all burst open and spoiled. Spoiled, apparently, but it was not so. They were better than raw ones. Fire is beautiful. Some day it will be useful, I think. Friday. I saw him again, for a moment, last Monday at nightfall, but only for a moment. I was hoping he would praise me for trying to improve the estate, for I had meant well and had worked hard. But he was not pleased, and turned away and left me. He was also displeased on another account. I tried once more to persuade him to stop going over the falls. That was because the fire had revealed to me a new passion, quite new, and distinctly different from love, grief, and those others which I had already discovered, fear. And it is horrible. I wish I had never discovered it. It gives me dark moments. It spoils my happiness. It makes me shiver and tremble and shudder. But I could not persuade him, for he has not discovered fear yet. And so he could not understand me. Extract from Adam's diary. Perhaps I ought to remember that she is very young, a mere girl, and make allowances. She is all interest, eagerness, vivacity. The world is to her a charm, a wonder, a mystery, a joy. She can't speak for delight when she finds a new flower. She must pet it and caress it, and smell it and talk to it, and pour out endearing names upon it. And she is color mad. Brown rocks, yellow sand, gray moss, green foliage, blue sky, the pearl of the dawn, the purple shadows on the mountains, the golden islands floating in crimson seas at sunset, the pallid moon sailing through the shredded cloud rack, the star jewels glittering in the wastes of space. None of them is of any practical value, so far as I can see. But because they have color and majesty, that is enough for her, and she loses her mind over them. If she could quiet down and keep still a couple of minutes at a time, it would be a reposeful spectacle. In that case, I think I could enjoy looking at her. Indeed, I am sure I could, for I am coming to realize that she is a quite remarkably comely creature. Lithe, slender, trim, rounded, shapely, nimble, graceful. And once, when she was standing marble-white and sun-drenched on a boulder, with her young head tilted back and her hand shading her eyes, watching the flight of a bird in the sky, I recognized that she was beautiful. Monday noon. If there is anything on the planet that she is not interested in, it is not in my list. There are animals that I am indifferent to, but it is not so with her. She has no discrimination. She takes to all of them. She thinks they are all treasures. Every new one is welcome. When the mighty Brontosaurus came striding into camp, she regarded it as an acquisition. I considered it a calamity. That is a good sample of the lack of harmony that prevails in our views of things. She wanted to domesticate it. I wanted to make it a present of the homestead and move out. She believed it could be tamed by kind treatment and would be a good pet. I said a pet 21 feet high and 84 feet long would be no proper thing to have about the place, because even with the best intentions and without meaning any harm, it could sit down on the house and mash it. For anyone could see by the look of its eye that it was absent-minded. Still, her heart was set upon having that monster, and she couldn't give it up. She thought we could start a dairy with it, and wanted me to help her milk it, but I wouldn't. It was too risky. The sex wasn't right, and we hadn't any ladder anyway. Then she wanted to ride it and look at the scenery. 30 or 40 feet of its tail was lying on the ground like a fallen tree, and she thought she could climb it, but she was mistaken. When she got to the steep place, it was too slick, and down she came, and would have hurt herself but for me. Was she satisfied now? No, nothing ever satisfies her but demonstration. Untested theories are not in her line, and she won't have them. She was born scientific. It is the right spirit, I concede it. It attracts me. I feel the influence of it. If I were with her more, I think I should take it up myself. Well, she had one theory remaining about this colossus. She thought that if we could tame him and make him friendly, we could stand him in the river and use him for a bridge. It turned out that he was already plenty tame enough, at least as far as she was concerned. So she tried her theory, but it failed. Every time she got him properly placed in the river and went ashore to cross over on him, he came out and followed her around like a pet mountain. Like the other animals. They all do that. Eve's Diary. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and today, all without seeing him. It is a long time to be alone. Still, it is better to be alone than unwelcome. I had to have company. I was made for it, I think. So I made friends with the animals. They are just charming, and they have the kindest disposition and the politest ways. They never look sour. They never let you feel that you are intruding. They smile at you and wag their tail, if they've got one. And they are always ready for a romp or an excursion or anything you want to propose. I think they are perfect gentlemen. All these days we have had such good times, and it hasn't been lonesome for me, ever. Lonesome? No, I should say not. Why, there's always a swarm of them around, sometimes as much as 4 or 5 acres. You can't count them. And when you stand on a rock in the midst and look out over the furry expanse, it is so mottled and splashed and gay with color and frisking sheen and sunflash, and so rippled with stripes that you might think it was a lake, only you know it isn't. And there's storms of sociable birds and hurricanes of whirring wings. And when the sun strikes all that feathery commotion, you have a blazing up of all the colors you can think of, enough to put your eyes out. We have made long excursions, and I have seen a great deal of the world. Almost all of it, I think. And so I am the first traveler. And the only one. When we are on the march, it is an imposing sight. There's nothing like it anywhere. For comfort I ride a tiger or a leopard, because it is soft and has a round back that fits me, and because they are such pretty animals. But for long distance or for scenery I ride the elephant. He hoists me up with his trunk, but I can get off myself. When we are ready to camp, he sits and I slide down the back way. The birds and animals are all friendly to each other, and there are no disputes about anything. They all talk, and they all talk to me, but it must be a foreign language, for I cannot make out a word they say. Yet they often understand me when I talk back, particularly the dog and the elephant. It makes me ashamed. It shows that they are brighter than I am, and are therefore my superiors. It annoys me, for I want to be the principal experiment myself, and I intend to be, too. I have learned a number of things, and am educated now, but I wasn't at first. I was ignorant at first. At first it used to vex me, because with all my watching, I was never smart enough to be around when the water was running uphill. But now I do not mind it. I have experimented and experimented, until now I know it never does run uphill, except in the dark. I know it does in the dark, because the pool never goes dry, which it would, of course, if the water didn't come back in the night. It is best to prove things by actual experiment. Then you know. Whereas if you depend on guessing and supposing and conjecturing, you will never get educated. Some things you can't find out, but you will never know you can't by guessing and supposing. No, you have to be patient and go on experimenting until you find out that you can't find out. And it is delightful to have it that way. It makes the world so interesting. If there wasn't anything to find out, it would be dull. Even trying to find out and not finding out is just as interesting as trying to find out and finding out, and I don't know but more so. The secret of the water was a treasure until I got it. Then the excitement all went away, and I recognized a sense of loss. By experiment I know that wood swims, and dry leaves and feathers, and plenty of other things, and therefore by all that cumulative evidence you know that a rock will swim. But you have to put up with simply knowing it, for there isn't any way to prove it, up to now. But I shall find a way. Then that excitement will go. Such things make me sad, because by and by, when I have found out everything, there won't be any more excitements. And I do love excitement so. The other night I couldn't sleep for thinking about it. At first I couldn't make out what I was made for. But now I think it was to search out the secrets of this wonderful world, and be happy and thank the giver of it all for devising it. I think there are many things to learn yet. I hope so. And by economizing and not hurrying too fast, I think they will last weeks and weeks. I hope so. When you cast up a feather, it sails away on the air and goes out of sight. Then you throw up a clod, and it doesn't. It comes down every time. I have tried it and tried it, and it is always so. I wonder why it is. Of course it doesn't come down, but why should it seem to? I suppose it is an optical illusion. I mean, one of them is. I don't know which one. It may be the feather, it may be the clod. I can't prove which it is. I can only demonstrate that one or the other is a fake, and let a person take his choice. By watching, I know that the stars are not going to last. I have seen some of the best ones melt and run down the sky. Since one can melt, they can all melt. Since they can all melt, they can all melt the same night. That sorrow will come. I know it. I mean to sit up every night and look at them as long as I can keep awake, and I will impress those sparkling fields on my memory, so that by and by, when they are taken away, I can, by my fancy, restore those lovely myriads to the black sky, and make them sparkle again, and double them by the blur of my tears. After the Fall. When I look back, the garden is a dream to me. It was beautiful, surpassingly beautiful, enchantingly beautiful, and now it is lost, and I shall not see it any more. The garden is lost, but I have found him, and am content. He loves me, as well as he can. I love him with all the strength of my passionate nature, and this, I think, is proper to my youth and sex. If I ask myself why I love him, I find I do not know, and do not really much care to know. So I suppose that this kind of love is not a product of reasoning and statistics, like one's love for other reptiles and animals. I think that this must be so. I love certain birds because of their song, but I do not love Adam on account of his singing. No, it is not that. The more he sings, the more I do not get reconciled to it. Yet I ask him to sing, because I wish to learn to like everything he is interested in. I'm sure I can learn, because at first I could not stand it, but now I can. It sours the milk, but it doesn't matter. I can get used to that kind of milk. It is not on account of his brightness that I love him. No, it is not that. He is not to blame for his brightness, such as it is, for he did not make it himself. He is as God made him, and that is sufficient. There was a wise purpose in it, that I know. In time it will develop, though I think it will not be sudden. And besides, there is no hurry. He is well enough just as he is. It is not on account of his gracious and considerate ways and his delicacy that I love him. No, he has lacks in these regards. But he is well enough just so, and is improving. It is not on account of his industry that I love him. No, it is not that. I think he has it in him, and I do not know why he conceals it from me. It is my only pain. Otherwise he is frank and open with me, now. I am sure he keeps nothing from me but this. It grieves me that he should have a secret from me, and sometimes it spoils my sleep thinking of it. But I will put it out of my mind. It shall not trouble my happiness, which is otherwise full to overflowing. It is not on account of his education that I love him. No, it is not that. He is self-educated, and does really know a multitude of things, but they are not so. It is not on account of his chivalry that I love him. No, it is not that. He told on me. But I do not blame him. It is a peculiarity of sex, I think, and he did not make his sex. Of course, I would not have told on him. I would have perished first. But that is a peculiarity of sex, too, and I do not take credit for it, for I did not make my sex. Then why is it that I love him? Merely because he is masculine, I think. At bottom he is good, and I love him for that, but I could love him without it. If he should beat me and abuse me, I should go on loving him. I know it. It is a matter of sex, I think. He is strong and handsome, and I love him for that, and I admire him and am proud of him. But I could love him without those qualities. If he were plain, I should love him. If he were a wreck, I should love him. And I would work for him and slave over him and pray for him and watch by his bedside until I died. Yes, I think I love him merely because he is mine and is masculine. There is no other reason, I suppose. And so I think it is, as I first said, that this kind of love is not a product of reasonings and statistics. It just comes, none knows whence, and cannot explain itself, and doesn't need to. it is what I think. But I am only a girl, and the first that has examined this matter, and it may turn out that in my ignorance and inexperience I have not got it right.
40 years later. It is my prayer, it is my longing that we may pass from this life together, a longing which shall never perish from the earth, but shall have place in the heart of every wife that loves until the end of time, and it shall be called by my name. But if one of us must go first, it is my prayer that it shall be I, for he is strong, I am weak. I am not so necessary to him as he is to me. Life without him would not be life. How could I endure it? This prayer is also immortal, and will not cease from being offered up while my race continues. I am the first wife, and in the last wife I shall be repeated.
At Eve's grave, Adam says, "Wheresoever she was, there was Eden." 1905.
This concludes the reading of The Best Short Stories of Mark Twain. This book was read by Robin Field. This unabridged recording was produced in 2009 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without written prior authorization from Blackstone Audio. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.